So here are some questions that I've received. A question about working on how the eighth grader is incarnating physically and how to connect that to the anatomy curriculum. Also, Mark brought up this question, how can or should parents be present in the classroom or supporting the class at the school site? We'll talk about that. So it's sort of a continuation of the parenting question. Another parenting question that I didn't address last time, what about fathers? It seemed I was speaking a lot about the mother's changing relationship to the child, particularly the astral umbilical cord. So what about the dad? How does he figure into this? Also, many students in your schools are not going to be going on to Waldorf high schools. They're going to suddenly enter into a ninth grade in which testing is king, in which they're taking lots of exams frequently. Should they already have been doing that? Should they be getting letter grades? These are all of these academic issues that are addressed. And I spoke about the class trip. I didn't say very much about the graduation. And what about that and how to work with that? So, okay, let's just go through some of these questions. So the first one, if the sixth grader's etheric body is strengthening the endocrine system for puberty, how is the eighth grader incarnating physically, and how do we connect that to the anatomy curriculum? Well, what's going on here, once again, this would take a whole conference in and of itself to go into in the detail it deserves, but in the most general way, the etheric body is very busy. And it's working on helping this tremendous growth spurt that for some children has been in place since grade 6, for others is beginning to come in earnest in grade 8, and for some will not really happen until grade 9 or even grade 10. But many in your class are certainly growing rapidly. Hopefully they're putting on some weight and you want to be concerned if there's an eating disorder or two. That's another issue we can talk about. So the etheric body is very busy with that, which means that rightfully it opens the way for the astral body to come powerfully. And for the first time, the astral body is able to actually go deeply into the human organism and take hold even of the skeletal system. This is why the child awakens to the skeleton. This is why there are these so-called growing pains, these aches and pains that feel like they're really happening in the bones, in the skeletal system. And this is also why this is a golden age of breaks, where children break a lot of bones. The astral body and its catabolic, even somewhat destructive forces are working into the skeleton. We can say in a general way, when we become conscious of something or when we're capable of being conscious of something, the astral body is active there. That's why the time that you studied in grade 7, the Renaissance, was the birth of the consciousness soul. But the consciousness soul means is that the astral body penetrates the physical body and we awaken. And that's why in the Renaissance, Leonardo, Vesalius, and finally hundreds of others felt so impelled and so entitled to open up the human body and began to penetrate it to its depths. We can't forget that up until this time, for example, the reproductive process of the human being was a complete mystery, and that there were more people in Europe believing that, you know, the stork brought the baby than there were believing that there was any internal process going on having to do with human sexuality that resulted in reproductive forces being activated. So it was only Fallopio, who was active at the same time as Michelangelo, who discovered then the basic, as we would call them today, principles of human reproduction. The astral body suddenly awakened there and was able to become conscious and explain things. So that's going on with the eighth grader. They are recapitulating the period of time demarcated by about the 15th to 17th centuries in Europe, and they are now able to look at their own skeleton in a conscious way. If the etheric body was still very active, that would block the perception. I mean, you could show them all the drawings you want or even bring a skeleton into the classroom. They're not going to experience it as their own. They're not going to be able to make a connection with that. And you may very well, in a class of, let's say, 20 children, have one or two children who go into a kind of sleep during the anatomy block. You know, they do the drawings, they write whatever you tell them, but you can see this is a little too soon for them. But the majority will be able to awaken to this. And this way, by teaching them about the skeleton, you guide them in a healthy way. You guide the astral body, and you show the formative relationships of, for example, as I showed you in the slideshow, the way the skull is in three parts, the way every bone is in three parts, that there's a threefold quality here. This calms down the astral body. What happens if human anatomy is not being taught in the right way to children of this age? I can guarantee you, you see this all around you. Go to the mall on Saturday, your local mall, and look at what the kids are wearing. And I'm talking about four-year-old kids as well as teenagers. Skeletons, skulls, skulls and crossbones, tattoos, earrings, T-shirts, you name it, it's all over the place. The astral body is crying out to learn about the skeleton in the right way. And when it's not taught it in the right way, the incarnation system and the incarnation process get to be a little bit bizarre. They get over-astralized, and you have this kind of worship of the skull and the crossbones. It's this kind of mass piracy. I recently saw there was a place where there had been a terrible auto accident in my locale, which is rural Pennsylvania, in the Kimberton area. So, of course, a whole kind of altar was set up around the tree, a big cross and all kinds of flowers, plastic flowers and all that. What was at the top of it? A big T-shirt with a skull and crossbones on it. Maybe it was a biker, and, this was his T-shirt or something, and it was put there as a tribute. It was really, really weird. But that's what is coming today when this incarnation process isn't guided in the right way. That's why this sense of reverence and this quality of form bring formativeness and bring the beauty and the interconnectedness of the forms of the bones to the children and the skeleton as a whole. And this will soothe the astral body because the astral body gets to see the skeleton in terms of all of the work that the etheric body has done on it. And this is tremendously important for children and goes literally and figuratively very, very deeply into their nature. So that's how teaching anatomy is a great aid. And of course, I wish we had more time. I'd love to go into the details of it, but you could see a little bit of that in the slideshow. Okay, the new Waldorf teacher used to parental help in the classroom. This is still Mark's question. How can or should parents be present in the class or supporting the class at the school site? I would give you a monosyllabic answer to that. No. if you didn't understand part of that, no, not at all. Keep the parents away. Let them help you on the class trip or on field trips. In the class play, but not in the classroom. This is really a very, very deep connection that you're forging the last time with the students. And the parents are only going to bring their own astral issues into it and their own criticalness. The worst thing you can do at any age, and it's exponentially worse at this age, is if a parent is complaining that their child isn't being paid enough attention to by you, or that their child claims she's behaving angelically and you're saying not, you want to prove to the parent that they're wrong and you're right, and you say, why don't you come in and see for yourself? I can't tell you how many teachers have gotten fired a week or two after that parent came in. It's just begging for a disaster. You know, let the parents stay outside the classroom and come and help you in extra ways. And even when you invite them to help you rehearse a play or go on a class trip, make sure it's the right parents, because parents can be a disastrous presence in other ways as well. And I'm speaking as one who loves parents and who's had wonderful connections with them and work very hard to cultivate them, but you have to recognize they have their right place and they have their wrong place. And it's very important that they not be involved with the pedagogy in the classic sense of it being in the classroom. And it may be a very different situation in the public school, but in the Waldorf school, everything between the teacher and students is much too intimate and delicate, and the parents' presence, having two egos in the room, or two astral bodies anyway, can really throw that off. Okay, just a couple of other things about parents. And honestly, if all that you get out of these 3 evenings of conversation is information about the parents, that's enough, because they are the most important key. They're the key to the success or lack of it with your class this year. Fathers, how do they figure? Really, really importantly, part of what happens when the youngster takes on his or her own karma in grade 6 with the coming of the astral body is that not only does the etheric pull back, but the astral strengthening also brings the male quality into the classroom. In another way of putting it, and this is facetious but not entirely so, we can say that in the first 5 to 6 grades, Waldorf schools are girls' schools that admit boys, that the boys are living in a very hyper-feminine atmosphere where the role of the mother is very important, where the goddess matriarchal spirit lives very strongly. But with 6th grade, that changes very rapidly. And by 7th grade, all the way to 12th grade, Waldorf schools become boys' schools that are admitting girls with the coming of the physical sciences, with a more intellectual approach to matter, with more of a stress on academics. Now it's more of a man's world, and the fathers suddenly feel safe and comfortable in that. So hopefully you've been cultivating the fathers the whole time and really wanting them to get involved. But now it's really a matter of necessity, that you want the dads to be coming with you on field trips if they can. And there are more dads with flex time nowadays who can take off time from work. It's not only the non-working mothers who can do that. And to get the dads to come on the class trip as well. Though once again, choose wisely. But, you know, it's really important for their connection to be there. Even if it's an absentee dad, even if it's a dad whom you hardly know. Maybe he's estranged, or he and the mom were divorced before you even took on the class, and you've never seen this guy. He may very well show up at a parent evening or a class play somewhere in grade 6, grade 7, and want to help and want to be involved. And I would really take that up very, very strongly. So fathers are meant to be more important and mothers less important. And it may be that when the mother gets very critical about you or very panicky about her child, particularly her daughter, that the father can provide a kind of mediating factor and really bring a little bit of calm and rationality into the situation. And I'm not trying to be stereotyping here or you know, sexist or anything, but I'm just describing phenomena that I think, you know, most teachers who've been through eighth grade have probably experienced. Now, how do you get the dads more involved? Number one, you've got to insist that they're coming to your parent evenings, which means you've got to make the parent evenings really interesting for them. How can this be done? Number one, if you've been kind of loose and lax about time, you've got to start the meeting on time and, above all, end the meeting on time. That means a lot to fathers. If you're going to end the meeting at 9:30 and at 9:29, somebody raises a hand, it's more often than not a mom, and brings up suddenly a totally inflammatory, upsetting question, then you've got to say, I'm sorry, we have to end the meeting. No, listen, Sally, if you want to talk with me about that issue, I'm staying on. If anybody wants to stay and talk about it, you know, you're all welcome. But everybody else, thank you for coming. Good night. It's 9:30. You've got to be that strong and that consequential about these times. This means a lot to fathers who may have to get up super early in the morning and be on their way. Something else that's important for fathers as you go up the grades, they want to feel that you are connected to the world. So here we come again to this issue of cultivating new interests. It's always good in every parent evening in the upper grades if you can make some comment or other about economics. If you can show that you are aware of issues in the financial world right now, you know, which banks have been caught in the latest scandal, how are financial bailout schemes working? Is the Federal Reserve in the United States or the Bank of England abroad, are they really, you know, getting anything done? You've got to speak about these issues and then make a connection to something the children are learning. You know, it might be good to say, you know, this is interesting. Just this year, when the Federal Reserve Bank is in the center of the news every day, this is in eighth grade, the year that students are learning about central banking systems. Isn't this fantastic? And they're learning how it came about, or they're learning about how insurance was invented and how, you know, the idea of containing risk came about through English shipping and mercantile agencies in the Renaissance and so on. This is great. And the dads really prick up their ears, and they're really interested in this. Secondly, show your interest in and knowledge of sports. Show the dads that you know how the home team is doing in baseball or football or basketball or soccer or hockey or whatever it is, that you're interested in that world, because this is super important to most men. And thirdly, be able to tell some jokes, some self-deprecating jokes, to show the fathers that you have a sense of humor, even a sense of humor about Waldorf education. Go to your local chain bookstore and see what joke books are on sale there, and just adapt those jokes to be about Waldorf kids or Waldorf teachers or something like that. It's not that hard. We actually do have a lot to joke about in our movement, and it's good for the parents to know that you are not simply a solemn, you know, totally serious individual carrying the weight of the world. But fathers like to see that there's a quality of lightness in all of that. And be ready to answer the dad's questions about how Waldorf kids do in the real world. You know, how do they do in real high schools? How do they do on their SATs or their college preparatory exams? How do they do when they're in college? You know, go to the OSMA site, Why Waldorf Works, and they have lots of statistics about that sort of thing. Find out if your school is old enough. Is there some kind of record that you have about how your students have done? You know, do you have some success stories? Maybe you even want to organize a little panel discussion one night in which you bring alumni back who can speak to your parents about how they've done. This speaks far more than all of your, you know, bland and vague assurances that everybody will do all right. And this also means a lot to fathers, because the mothers are very much connected to the early years, you know, to birth and what follows birth. But the dads are very interested in the future of the child. That's really their responsibility. The mom's question is my child happy? The father's question is, will my child succeed? And in one way or another, you've got to be giving them assurance about that. One more thing about parents, and then I'm going to open up, you know, the floor a little bit. I'll unmute that if there are some questions or discussion about this. Okay, so you've got the dads who are increasingly getting interested in what you're doing and wanting to work along with you. Now, if you are a young or sometimes not even that young female teacher, and the dad is getting really interested in the class and really interested in what's going on in eighth grade, that can sometimes lead the mom to get jealous. She's already been jealous of you for a few years because of your deep connection with her child, okay? She's kind of made her peace with that. Now suddenly, out of the blue, her husband's getting interested in school and showing up at more and more meetings and, you know, agreeing to go on field trips or, God forbid, a class trip with you. Watch it. Really watch out and be sure that, you know, everything's on the up and up and that there's no undue jealousy on the part of the mother. Because this is a time where in the disruptiveness of the astral umbilical cord severing, in the difficulties of her child suddenly growing rebellious or difficult or fresh or whatever, these can be very trying times for mothers. And they're going to look around and try to see, you know, are there outer causes, are there outer circumstances that they can blame, that it's not their fault, but rather something else is going on. The more you explain to parents about this umbilical cord, the healthier it is all around. But even so, you're going to have parents looking to you, looking at you as the cause for everything that's not quite going right at home. So be prepared for the jealousy of mothers. All you need is one parent who has it in for you in eighth grade, and you can be out the door very quickly. Or this can be your last year in your school. You know, things happen very, very rapidly in eighth grade. It's like Grace Paley wrote a short story with the title, Enormous Changes at the Very Last Moment. And that's exactly what can happen in eighth grade. Really watch your back and be sure that things are clear with you and the mothers, and that it's not just suddenly that the fathers are rallying around you and the mothers are hating you, but you want those mothers to continue to be involved as well. That's extremely important. Okay, now let me take the muting off And if anybody would like to say something or ask something in relation to that.
Eugene, I have a comment.
Yes, Michael.
I wondered, yesterday you spoke a lot about keeping a good connection with the parents through phone calls. I wondered what you might have to say about cultivating that a little at dismissal time. I find that's a very good time to be lighthearted and yet to convey things to parents.
That's a good question. I think if you, Michael, have found that is successful for you, then certainly go ahead and do it. The difficulty with that is that the circumstance there is one in which you have to be a bit reactive. You know, that it's not like you've made the phone call. You can now speak to the parents.
Collins, muted.
I'm just muting it so we don't get too much echo. But when you're talking after school, then in a way, you know, you're not sure which parent may be coming up to you and what they want to speak about. Secondly, and here again, you may have the stamina that's needed. Many teachers, by the end of a day in eighth grade, are completely wiped out. They're really, really tired. You know, maybe they're anticipating a meeting, a committee meeting, or a faculty meeting. They're not looking forward to it or whatever. So often your mood may not be best, your resilience, your flexibility, your humor. And as you say, if it can be kept lighthearted and bring some levity to it, that can be wonderful. But generally, most teachers are probably wise at that time to say to the parent, you know, this isn't such a good time to talk. Why don't you ask the secretary when my next free time is? You know, that you have office hours, you have phone call office hours if parents want to call you in addition to you calling them. That way, in a way, you give yourself protection and space. If you have the, you know, as I say, if you have that kind of savoir-faire and can do that, then by all means, continue it. But it's nothing that I generally recommend.
Yeah, thank you, Eugene. I can easily see that. It probably depends a lot on the geography and how rapidly cars are going and all sorts of things.
It's a very, very delicate situation. Yes.
Yeah.
We often speak of the parking lot, the parking lot syndrome in the Waldorf school where parents are talking with each other. And as you say, even the presence of all the cars and the movement and the agitation around getting the children packed away in the car and off, all of this makes school a little bit edgier very often.
Yeah.
Any other questions? Well, let me go on, and I want to speak now about the graduation and ways of approaching this. So once again, pardon me if I mute you all. It's not because I want you to be quiet, but just so that we don't get that
conference muted.
Echoing. I have been to, I don't know how many, probably 100 graduations, eighth grade graduations over the years. Because sometimes I've been to several in one year where I've been consulting in a school and visiting one after another. And some of the weaknesses that I've seen, especially in younger schools, but sometimes surprisingly even in established schools that have had years and years of experience with the graduation, the biggest weakness is it is not used effectively enough as what it is, number one, which is not even an event for the children. They've said their farewells. They've said their goodbyes to one another, to the teacher. They've had their class play. They've had their heart-to-heart conversation around the fire in your class trip. You know, they don't need the graduation in a certain respect. It's there for the parents. It's there for the grandparents. It's there for the other children in the school who are going to have this event coming their way in a year or two or three. And it is also there for people who just for one reason or another, you know, in-laws, cousins, whatever, people basically coming off the street for whom this is their first experience of Waldorf education. It is above all one of the major public relations events for the school, and it's almost never used this way. What are things that are very often done? The teacher begins by saying, everything I'm going to say now, I'm saying to the children. So you're just all listening in. This is between me and the children. I would not do that. You've already done that. What have you been doing for the last 8 years? Talking to a hole in the wall? Of course you've been talking to the children. This isn't you and the children. This is you explaining to the entire world what goes on in a Waldorf classroom. This is your chance to tell the grandparents who may have been paying the tuition, to tell the in-laws who've been complaining for years that why doesn't the child know how to read and write? Why doesn't she use a computer in school? This is your chance to tell them what you've been doing and why these children are such an exceptional group. This is your chance to explain when four children are playing chamber music. Now, let me tell you, everyone, it's not just that these four children are musically gifted. Everybody in this class plays music. Any group of children in the class could be playing chamber music for you. We just don't have the time for everybody, so this group is doing it. When they recite poetry, explain, what you're going to hear now is Martin Luther King's letter from the Birmingham jail, because in our school, we don't only read great poetry of the past, but we find poetry even in modern politics. And we studied the life of Martin Luther King, and we looked at the struggle of the African-American people in America and so on. You know, lay it on. Let people know that everything they are hearing and seeing is exceptional, unusual, is only to be found in the Waldorf classroom and nowhere else. And you should also have an exhibit of the students' workout so that people can see what they've done. And it shouldn't just be off in some corner. The whole room should be emblazoned with paintings and drawings and samples of student work on the walls and handwork and things that they've done from grade one on. And you must be in charge of the graduation. If there's a tradition in your school that the graduation is a gift from the children and that they create the ceremony and that they get the specialty teachers and their parents involved, I would say end that tradition at your very first faculty meeting. That is really bad. The children do not know what in the world they should be doing in such an event. They're only going to copy what last year's eighth grade group did, which probably was very unsatisfactory. You are in charge of this. This is your class's last major event. Don't throw it away and entrust it to parents who may or may not have any clue about what Waldorf education is really all about. Make this your last class. This is your last teaching event in which you are teaching the whole world about what a Waldorf classroom is. So that's also very, very important. And I would say these graduations are usually so kind of intimate and in crowd with in jokes and in comments that most people attending them, including other faculty members, feel completely excluded. And all they feel is that they're looking on to something private, and why did they bother coming anyway? And no, I'm not going to donate that $100,000 to the school that I was planning on doing. I feel I was just left out of this event. So don't do it that way. Make it your event. Think of it as a threefold event. How can you bring something for the thinking, the feeling, and the willing? think of it as a way to, you know, thank the parents, thank the grandparents, to really recognize all of the gifts that have come your way, but also to really show what it means when there is a connection of soul and spirit between a teacher and children. You know, and that should really shine. You don't know who in that audience may be a future Waldorf teacher, who in that audience may come back 5 years later and make a major donation to the school, who in that audience may have a deep karmic connection with you, but won't know it until they really hear you speaking with great clarity. You know, don't make the event an hour long. 45 minutes is probably plenty, but make every one of those 45 minutes really count. So these are things that I would suggest very strongly. When do you start planning the graduation? The first day of school. Start to talk to the students about it. Start to think about it. Every poem that you teach them, everything they're doing in music, in foreign language, everything should be thought of as potentially part of the graduation. So that, you know, when the time comes, you have a lot of material from which to choose. And you are, in the end, you are in charge. The children may have lots of suggestions. Listen to them. Take them seriously. But in the end, you are the one who's going to create that agenda. Make sure that the program that's created is beautiful. Don't just let the children scrawl on it. Same with their class play posters. They should show what a student learns in 8 years. They shouldn't look like a shopping list or something. So make it all beautiful and meaningful. That's very, very important that from, you know, the time the invitation is sent, that those who receive those invitations feel that here's a work of beauty and meaning, so that the graduation really is all that it can be. Now, let me go back to one detail of that graduation that has ramifications throughout the school year and throughout all of the years in which you teach. I mentioned we'll have things hanging on the walls, and I'm sure that your thought is, yeah, paintings, because paintings are loose, right? You paint on a sheet of paper, and you can hang that up easily. Main lesson books, they're always a problem. How do you hang a main lesson book up on the wall? Do you stick push pins in it? Those usually don't do a very good job. Main lesson books are always falling on the floor in the hallway, getting stepped on as children run through the hall, or kids rub against them and the pages get dog-eared, or they tear or whatever, or the students need to work on them. And they can't just share their main lesson book with the world when it's unfinished. This is what I suggest. This raises tremendous hackles in some Waldorf teachers, so I'm aware, you know, not all of you may agree with this. You've seen the slideshows that I have in our website. Those slideshows are taken from primarily main lesson books. How did I do it? I scanned the main lesson book pages, or I also photographed them. And nowadays, like a smartphone, you can actually use that phone as a scanner and do a scan that's as good, if not better, than what a scanning machine does. So I scanned them. I did color correction if need be. I lightened up the background. Not all of them are perfect by any means. When I had those scans in my class, when I was still teaching that class, I took those scanned images, printed them out on my computer's printer, and I hung those up in the hall. So that way a student could still be working on her main lesson book, maybe on page 17 of the book, and the other 16 pages in reproduction form were hanging up in the hallway. School for painters and those who do form drawing, they don't see anything else. They get these preconceptions, misconceptions about the school, that the children never do any writing. This way, you can show their written work alongside their artistic work. And along with that, that's not enough. You can't just then write grade 8 work on that. You've got to explain what the parents are seeing. So you do curating. You write an explanation, which you can type out nicely on a piece of paper, 8.5 by 11, large type, so people don't have to struggle to read it. Now I want to open the floor to Clara.
Yes, I do have a question. Do you have any suggestions for a graduation for two persons, like one person, two person?
Yes, that's a very good question. I would just say that you make it something. I wouldn't make it, you know, an overwhelmingly large event. Now you have. I know that you're in the fellowship community, that you're embedded there, and you have that wonderful space of the Goethe Room. And what might be nice is if you could have not just the eighth graders present, but also have some maybe sixth and seventh graders, if you have any, in that grade. I know that you have a fifth grade because Marisa Chin is taking our grade 5 conference right now. But if you have a few students to be there, and maybe you could recite a poem, maybe you could sing a song if they're able to do that as well, so that it's not just the eighth graders, those one or two who have to carry everything. It's more of an event for the school. Maybe it's like a farewell event where the whole school is bidding goodbye to the eighth graders, but the eighth graders aren't just in the spotlight, you know, having to perform for everyone.
That's a good idea.
That might be something you could do.
Yeah. No, that's a great suggestion. Thank you.
Yeah. When I taught my group at the Otter Spec School, there were, we had 4 eighth graders at that time. And we had, you know, a very small event in which, you know, each one of them recited a poem individually and sang a song together. It was very, very simple. And at that time, the whole school was very small. I think now you'd, in a way, be able to draw on a larger group of students.
Yeah, it's true.
Okay?
Yeah, thank you.
You're very welcome, Clara. So anyone else with a question? If you want to show that. Hello, Michael.
Hello. Trying to
Hi, you got muted for a moment. I can hear you now, though.
Yes. So I wanted to say, first of all, excellent ideas about scanning work and putting it up on the wall. Another suggestion, you know, we've mounted paintings and drawings and then put 2 long folding tables, which we've covered with purple cloth, and then used that to arrange heavy items and books underneath the wall where the visual display is on. So it's just another way.
Oh, very good. Yeah, of course, you'd want, because for handwork and three-dimensional work, for sure.
Right,
you'd want
yeah.
That. And also if there are, you know, class photos, now more and more classes are wanting to create something like what that girl Katie did that you have, you know, connected to the website. They're wanting to make little videos of their class and things that they've done. And I would say, you know, that they should do that, but once again, be sure that you have something to do with that and that you have an idea of what it looks like. Because children at this age, number one, their taste is not always great. Their judgment is not always so clear. And also they may just not have the technical skills to do something that they'd really like to do. That girl, Katie, was an exceptionally gifted impresario of the camera and knew how to do all the editing, most students, you hope they're not. It might be a little bit premature. So if they want to do something with media, I wouldn't necessarily discourage it, but I would be sure that you kept looking at it, you know, and that it wasn't a last-minute thing that they keep promising to do and then throw together at the last moment. So that's something to think about. I think increasingly students are going to want to produce something like that.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions? So I would like to go on and speak now more specifically about what I call the, you know, academic panic that may start to set in this year. And I want to speak about some solutions that schools have been working out to help this. We all know by now, you know, you're on the threshold of eighth grade, nobody has a class that is as academically accomplished as we might hope. You know, there are always going to be those students who are way behind in math in particular. That's usually a prevalent weakness in the Waldorf classroom in the upper grades. Not only the Waldorf classroom, but that's the one that we're in. And usually our level of achievement there is not what we might have hoped, you know, given all the great ideas that Rudolf Steiner gives and all the other ideas that Waldorf practitioners, Jamie York, for example, have worked out, have helped us with. Still, math remains a kind of mystery. Secondly, most eighth graders, their grammar is not, their understanding of grammar, their ability to parse a sentence and so on, is generally not all that it should be. Their ability to write compositions, probably you have a range of children who are writing at a 10th or 11th grade level. That's usually two or three of the girls in a class, and some boys who are still writing on a third or fourth grade level. You know, I don't know what to write about. I don't have any ideas. Do I have to write long sentences and so on? That range is also a little bit too wide a range, too broad a range than we might like. And then on top of that, you have those children who are still handing in everything late, who struggle to finish their main lesson books, who perhaps have a trail of main lesson books from the last 3 years that haven't been finished, not to speak of their woodworking projects and their handwork projects. And then there's the artistic caliber and children who once again have hardly made much improvement in their drawing since the middle school years, and others who work meticulously and gorgeously, but whose influence doesn't seem to have spread very far in the classroom. Now, I'm, you know, perhaps giving here a kind of extreme composite, but I'm sure that at least some of what I've said is reflected in your own class. Okay, what do we do about this? Now, of course, as years have gone by and there have been, you know, generations of parents of children in grades 6, 7, and 8, there has been an increasing sense of anxiety and even panic among parents in the upper grades. I can't tell you how many times when I'm visiting a school, I'm asked to attend a meeting of the 6th grade teacher or the 7th grade teacher or both, with a group of very, very upset parents who have just realized that their child doesn't know how to write, that their child is way behind in math, where the class teacher in reports in June has kept saying, everything's fine, next year he'll do better, we'll keep improving. And of course, as you go up the grades, there aren't that many next years left. So parents get very panicky. The school gets very distressed. It may be that one or two teachers get fired over the next month. Or, in order to placate the parents, the teacher, the school promises we will bring in an expert. We'll bring in a high school teacher, either from our own school or another Waldorf school in the area, and that person will do an intensive with the children in grammar. And then the next year, the school decides, so that they don't have to deal with that panic and crisis meeting again, why don't we just hire somebody to be the language arts teacher in grade 8, or grade 8 and grade 7? Or why don't we have a math specialist teacher coming in for grade 8, or grade 8 and grade 7, or grade 8, 7, and 6, or grade 5, 4, 3. What's happening is what I alluded to on Monday evening, the incredible disappearing class teacher. And it is not unusual that in many schools, especially established schools, nowadays, the grade A teacher, the class teacher, as we used to call her, is only teaching half of the blocks, and the other half are being taught by specialists. Maybe a parent who's a physicist is doing the electricity and magnetism block. A parent who is a chemist is doing the organic chemistry block. A high school teacher is coming in to do the French Revolution block. And another high school teacher is coming in to do the meteorology block, and so on. And the class teacher is left with a couple of history blocks and maybe a math block, but can we even trust her for that? This is, I think, this is a tendency that was starting to occur in the 1990s in a handful of schools, but has accelerated to almost exponential point since one day, since the day of 9/11/2001. The fear, the sense that there is no security, the anxieties that have taken hold of Americans, and really around the world, everybody, but particularly in North America, these fears appear everywhere, not just in airports and movie theaters. They also appear in the Waldorf classroom. We like to think that we are a kind of haven, you know, a castle with a moat into which such things don't enter. But they live in our parents, and the parents convey them osmotically via their umbilical cords to the children. And finally, they live among the faculty. And there's panic, 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 that we're going to lose parents, we're going to lose children, we can't afford it, our enrollment is low as it is, you know, you're fired unless you allow the specialty teachers to take over for you. So the class teacher becomes increasingly, in the upper grades, right now it's primarily grades 7 and 8, and I'm starting to see it in grade 6 as well. Give another 7 years. By the year 2020, when Waldorf education is 100 years old, we will have specialty teachers teaching math and language arts in grade 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and 8. By grade 8, there probably won't even be a class teacher anymore. It'll basically be a group of specialists, specialty teachers, high school teachers doing this. So we, you know, this is what's happening. Why is it happening? Mainly, not just because parents are panicking, not just because administrators are freaking out and, you know, just trying to push the panic button and make it all well. That's their job. It's happening because you, class teachers, are allowing it to happen. If all of the class teachers in a school said, no, we can teach these subjects ourselves. We are the class teacher. Class teachers are meant to be generalists, not specialists. We're meant to work hard and get better at subjects. And even if we're not perfect, like a specialty teacher is, we can teach them well enough, and the children have a model of somebody with a polymath, a generalist, who's interested in every subject. If the class teachers would assert that, this panicky specialist in every grade stuff would go away as quickly as it has come. But instead, we tend to be too passive about it. And some class teachers, I think, even welcome it. Well, I was always afraid of sixth grade math anyway, or, oh, I really suck at chemistry. You know, I'm so glad somebody else is going to do it. And what we're doing when we do this, when we shrink down to a shell or a kind of a husk, we are actually denying ourselves one of the most important aspects of the class teacher's job, which is the initiation experience. The struggles that we have trying to get good at various subjects, the threshold that we have to cross to get enthusiastic about chemistry or meteorology or anatomy or even English grammar, those struggles are what make us able to go through an initiation experience so that the next time we go through the grades, we are working from a much higher and much deeper level. And by bringing in all these specialty teachers, we're denying ourselves a very important spiritual experience, which means then that because we're not going through a kind of modern initiation, which is what Steiner built in to the Waldorf curriculum, if we're not going through that, we are depriving our students a chance to go through an initiation on their own level. That the Waldorf curriculum comes out of the ancient mysteries, and what children are going through is something that is an initiation on a young person's level, an initiation into modern life. And bring in a host of specialty teachers, yeah, they'll get the math. Yeah, they'll be able to parse sentences. Congratulations. You know, they could do that within 3 months in high school as well. They don't need to get so great at all that stuff. But what they do need is the experience of a living, breathing human being in front of them who is struggling with the attainment of knowledge as much as they are, as deeply as they are. Okay, so that's sort of the deeper, more anthroposophical side of that. On another level, and you know, you guys are in living, breathing schools, and you may be able to say more about this than I can. I have never found a single school in all of the schools that I visit that can prove to me that the math specialist has actually improved the level of this class in math beyond what the class teacher has been doing or could have done, that the language arts specialist is improving the level of the children. There's no proof. It's totally 100% anecdotal at this point. And people are just assuming it's working and soothes the parents, but the parents don't really look into it that deeply. They don't really know what's going on. They just know there's a specialist there and they feel better. It's, you know, throwing them a piece of meat to sop their appetite for specialists, but I don't think there's anything of real substance to it. The children on so many levels would be better off if their class teacher was working with math, was working with grammar. And definitely it's not to say, you know, we shouldn't be working with it, not that we can just take for granted. And I would say that the best way of doing this is to take a students who are struggling, particularly in math and grammar, and I hate to say this to you, but the best way of doing it is working with them on Saturday mornings, having Saturday morning tutorials with small numbers of students whom you work with for 3 hours on a Saturday morning. And maybe you work with them for 4 Saturdays in a row, and then you take a break of 2 Saturdays, then you go back again. You can work miracles when you work with students like this, because one of the disadvantages for slow learners in the Waldorf classroom is the sheer size of the group and the speed with which everything is going. And in math in particular, Malcolm Gladwell showed in his wonderful study of math in his book, The Outliers, that's Malcolm, math takes time, that students can actually generally do a lot better in math than their achievement scores would indicate if time. And the main lesson, we're generally in a big rush. We're trying to get a lot of stuff done. Take them on a Saturday morning, give them more individual attention, groups of three or four, I wouldn't have any more than that, and calmly, systematically go right back to first grade if you must, and see where their strengths are. And you'll see improvement. Now, Saturday morning, it may not lead to improvement in your personal life. It may not lead to improvement in your family life. In fact, it could actually be very destructive of your personal life and family life to take all of that time on a Saturday when your family never sees you as it is. So that's happening. Here's the middle ground. Here's the solution. In a certain way, there isn't. Not in eighth grade. If you still have children with particular needs, either you do that, or the parents will secretly or blatantly be taking them off to the computer club tutoring services after school, which are also generally a travesty. Those tutoring things generally are giving the children a quick fix, which seems to bring them up to speed for a few weeks, and then they're right back where they are. It's symptomatic. It's like giving the child, you know, a strong medicine for a symptom and not really getting to the constitutional issue that lies at the basis of that illness. So that is one solution I would say that we have to watch out for, the incursion, the invasion of the specialty teachers in our schools. We should not forget that Steiner intended the Waldorf schools to be for the children of factory work. These were children whose parents worked all day on an assembly line, you know, where they were specialists in rolling up the cigarettes, in stuffing the tobacco, in wrapping the cellophane, putting the cigarette packs into cartons, whatever they did. He wanted Waldorf education to be an artisan activity, to be something that is taught by craftspeople who don't work on an assembly line, but rather work with every step of the way of that pot, from clay to glaze, work every step of the with that wood cabinet, from chopping down the tree and drying it to varnishing it. He wanted us to be artisans, not factory workers. And we are reversing what Stein wanted 100 years later. We're turning it inside out and making the Waldorf school a factory. Frankly, a lot of these kids would be better off learning from a computer than going from specialty teacher to specialty teacher. At least the computer, there'd be, you know, one program in front of them, or you'd be there guiding them. So I would say that's not the solution. The solution is for you to work more specifically with those students of yours needing that special work. That's number one. Number two, and then I'll open up for questions, objections, or anything else you'd like to bring. Number two is don't worry. The word worry must be removed from your vocabulary in grade 8. Indeed, there are a lot of things now that are beyond your control. You or the teachers who taught the class before you, maybe you're their third or fourth teacher, that happens nowadays. Maybe you took them on in grade 6 and you've been playing catch up ever since. Whatever it is, you know, things are now at a point where you cannot simply turn everything around and make problems go away and make academic shortfalls disappear overnight. You can do a lot. There are amazing changes that can occur in grade 8. There's amazing maturity that sometimes happens. I can tell you there were kids in my class who in the last week of school, suddenly got it and suddenly were on the verge of doing incredible work. They went on to ninth grade, and what happened? The high school teachers got all credit for turning them around and so on. You know, and it may look that way sometimes. With boys, you're not going to see how well you did until those guys are at the end of 11th grade. That's when you'll see whether you really helped the boys in your class or not. Up until then, you have no clue whether they're just really stupid or they're slow or you messed up or their parents messed up, whatever. Wait till 11th grade and you'll see the result. In fact, Steiner tells us we don't really know how well we did as teachers until our students, as class teachers, until our students are in 50s, okay? I have some students who are approaching that age, and I'll know in the end whether I did any good for them or not. That's how long it takes. So calm down. Right now, you are really going to do the very best you can, and don't let anybody bring their panic into your life. You have to be an instrument of serenity. You really have to be the one who's soothing the wild breast that's living in the, you know, astral bodies gone wild in your parents and the children as well. You know, the important thing now is that you are really giving the children all of those subjects that eighth grade brings in the deepest and fullest way possible. And, of course, we'll be speaking more specifically about the subjects on Friday. Now, I'll bring one other thing, and then I open the floor to all of you. Okay, it may be that some of your students early on in the fall are going to be taking the entry examinations for local secondary schools. And these entry examinations are not easy exams. They're very, very demanding, very difficult. So don't worry about, you know, that's going to happen and you can't do much about it. I'll tell you, though, what you can do. Other students, you want to feel that by the time they leave eighth grade and go into high school, they at least know what a test is, what an exam is, you know, that they're not just complete sacrificial lambs when they end up in ninth grade. So here's what I suggest. Number one, and, of course, this is too late for some of you because your school told you you have to give block tests. And maybe you've been doing this since grade 5 or 6. I don't know. My advice is never, ever give a block test. Don't get testing mixed up with main lesson. You can teach the children how to take tests right away in eighth grade if they haven't taken them before. You do one or two extra names a week in which you start to create simple and ever more complicated multiple choice exams and reading comprehension exams for the students. And then finally, by mid-October, you start to bring in real exams from real books. I have done this with my class. Now, I actually started about the last third of grade 7. But I wasn't so ahead of where you are right now. They learned the difference between understanding a subject and learning a subject and knowing a subject and taking a test. They got to see that tests are really not rocket science, that they prove very little, and that they say nothing about what you really know and what you really understand. All they tell you is how well you've, as we say, psyched out, you know, psychologized the person or the committee that wrote the test. That's all that's telling you. So teach the test as a separate skill, the way the PE teacher would teach broadcasting, which has nothing to do with main lesson, but it's a separate skill. the way the basketball coach is teaching the kids, you know, how to shoot a foul shot or something like that. It's not main lesson stuff. It belongs somewhere else. And in these classes, you are the coach rather than the teacher. So I would say do whatever you can not to mix up class teaching, main lesson work, and those sacred subjects that you teach, and the giving of exams. If you don't know whether your children have learned things in a main lesson by looking at them, by sensitively hearing their responses when you have reviews, by having conversations with them individually, if you need a block test to know whether these students who you've been teaching perhaps for years are learning anything, there's something wrong there. You know, you really have to examine yourself in a way as a teacher and ask, why can't I tell by looking into their eyes, by letting my astral body wander into their soul, whether they're learning something or not? So you're teaching them to take tests as a purely, you know, practical technique that they're going to be needing very soon, but not as something that's really contributing to their knowledge base, as something that they're really learning and benefiting from. Okay, so those are some thoughts about how not to go manic about academic panic. And now, you know, I'm going to unmute you guys. And if anybody has a question, if you want to try pressing that question control, we'll see if that comes up.
Eugene, can you hear me? This is Chris.
Chris, I hear you loud and clear. Thank you.
I have a question. Our school, basically because of enrollment decline, has sort of broken down a bit the model of a single class teacher and her island of her class. And
yes.
Not so much that we're bringing in outside specialty teachers to do the math and language arts, but sometimes we're combining classes or we're stepping into someone else's classroom to teach, you know, I've done math for other teachers. So it's not bringing in someone from outside the school or from a high school, but sort of pooling resources as a faculty. What's your thought about this in terms of moving into middle school with a little bit more of a collaborative teaching model?
Well, there again, how is that working? Does that seem to be making a positive difference for the students? Is it too soon to tell?
I think it's been a revolution for our school. It took us from a sort of poverty mentality and thinking that we were combining classes and shrinking, and instead it feels more like we know more students, we can talk collaboratively and carefully about students, because I might have 6th, 7th, and 8th graders at some point during the week, and so I can really work with my colleagues on that.
Yes, yes. And you're speaking about classes that are how big? How large would each of those classes be?
Well, my class at its smallest was down to 6 students. And we go, last year I taught a class of 21 students. It was my class and the grade below. It would have been a 6th and 7th grade language arts class that I did together.
Well, I think, you know, given those numbers and the way you're describing it, and the fact that it's class teachers who are working with one another's classes, that's a very big, very different picture from what I was giving, you know, as something that I would have tried to avoid. I think this sounds like, under the circumstances, a very good step to take. Were the classes to eventually increase in size, you know, swell up to be 15 or 18 or 20 children each, it might not be practical anymore to do that. You might want to find other ways to collaborate with each other. So I would say that sounds good. The main thing about doing anything like that is it's good to make it, to give it a kind of time limit, to say, let's do this for the next 3 years, and then let's review. You know, not that every year we're going to decide in the summer or late in the spring or even in the fall, is this what we want to do or not? But that we say, let's commit to this for a period of time so teachers find it worthwhile to start preparing for working outside of their own, you know, class, their own grade. And then after 3 years or so, maybe 2 years, maybe 4 years, let's review it. Let's see what we learned. Let's see what the benefits were. What were the disadvantages? Something like that is very good and very important, because there's no question, even among the largest, most established schools, that combined classes are not going away, that they are something that's here and might even be the model for the 21st century. It may be that we're not going to just have the luxury of going grade by grade, but that at times we will have to double up or even triple up, that the independent schools are, you know, having to face a new kind of parameter. And just one other comment about this. You know that metaphors are very, very powerful. And I remember when I was teaching at Green Meadow Waldorf School, and Ann Shapiro was a colleague of mine there for a while as well, that there we often spoke about the kings and the queens. You know, that the class teachers were the kings and the queens. And when they got together on Thursdays, it was very hard for them to adjust to having peers, because all week long you were ruling the roost, and suddenly you had people who dared to think of themselves as your equals, and that was always difficult. That metaphor, kings and queens, was one way of describing class teachers. We could also have said, these class teachers were all foot soldiers, and when they got together on Thursdays, they were all equals, of course, because they were all in the battle together in a way. You know, that would change the way we looked at one another, and it would make collaboration easier. To call a class, to say the class teacher has her own island, which was obviously, you know, a metaphor used in your school, or their own castle, or their own whatever, you know, their own kingdom. This metaphor makes us think about the class teacher in a way that can't help be negative. You know, oh yeah, they think, you know, they rule the world or whatever. And there have got to be other metaphors that we can use that maybe make it sound like the class teacher is less of a menacing, egotistical, self-centered person. I don't think all class teachers are necessarily that way. There are temptations to be that way, but I think there are other possibilities too.
Absolutely, yeah, and I think that for us it was also how isolated, and this kind of goes back to Monday, how isolated we might feel on our own island without, you know, without colleague support as well.
Important that, you know, for the eighth grade teacher in particular, it's really good to be able to feel there are others here helping me. And of course, sometimes we tend to forget the powerful role that's played by those who are correctly specialty teachers, the handwork teacher, the foreign language teacher, the PE teacher, and so on. And often we're not in a way calling upon them and their wisdom and their experience of the children, because those people generally know every child in the grade school. They teach all of them. They know brothers and sisters going back years or going ahead years. So they're also people whose, you know, pool of information and experience we should not hesitate to call upon.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Any other questions?
Eugene, this is Mark. I've got a question.
Go ahead, Mark. We can hear you loud and clear.
Great. You were speaking about how some kids are developing for math and they may need some more practice on Saturday.
Yes.
And you mentioned the phrase you used was that there may be a constitutional do with some of their deficits, and I was wondering if you could expand on that or give some other examples of what that
Yes, sure. Sure, I'd be happy to speak about that. Okay, and I'll say a little bit about that. There are children in a class who we might say have the world of number and form, geometrical form in particular, deeply living within them. So deeply living that they can't separate it from their physical etheric body. They can't draw it out and put it in a free space where they can start to work with it. So such children are going to struggle greatly from grade one on, and definitely in the middle school years, they're going to struggle greatly with the most basic aspects of arithmetic, not to speak of understanding mathematics after grade four. Now, something like fractions will be almost impossible for them. Why? Because fractions live in the human skeletal system, and we start to work with fractions in grade four just when the bones are starting to assume the particular sizes and shapes that really put them in a fractional relationship with one another. If we think of the long bones of the arm and then the carpal bones and the finger bones and so on, we're really speaking there of fractional relationships. They have that living strongly within them. How do we know this? Because these are children who often will be in PE class, the stars, the jumpers, the ones who can make quick reflex movements, the pitchers in baseball, the great goal shooters in basketball, the, kickers in soccer, whatever, amazingly adept in what Howard Gardner in his book about the intelligences would call the spatial and the kinesthetic intelligences, which he says are terribly underrated in the Western industrial world, the world of tests. So these children have the numbers living within them. They are going to make them manifest in their movement, in their spatial connections. They may be incredible in knitting. They may be really good in woodworking. They may also do very well in form drawing, even though they can't formulate geometry. They can't put it into a numerical relationship, but in a way they can draw it. They can experience it. Such children, if you, let's say, put them in a high-pressure tutoring class, or if you keep, you know, making them do problem after problem after problem because they're not getting it, you may be doing very great damage to the connection of their physical and etheric bodies. You may be doing them physical harm, which when they get into their 50s and 60s are going to lead to a host of constitutional chronic illnesses. So what do you do with them? You have to understand that they simply may never be very good with numbers and math in the school setting. However, later on in life, individuals like this sometimes become entrepreneurs. They become self-starting, self-initiating business people who suddenly have to work with numbers, and it rises up out of them as though they never struggled with it. Suddenly it's there when they need it because people left them alone and did not force them. But I would say math, this is a very constitutional matter. And probably you have up to 20% of your class are children who by and large would benefit from not having to do much math work at all. You just have to be able to explain that to their teachers, to their your colleagues, I should say, and to the parents. But that's a very big step for a teacher to take. Steiner goes so far as to say that one of the sure signs that somebody was a math genius in a previous life is that they have absolutely no connection whatsoever to math in this life. and that they're people who have no reason whatsoever to learn anything about numbers or to be connected with them because they were geniuses in math in their last life, and now they need a rest from that. That's something you have to really go deeply to determine if that's the case. But I'm just saying that certainly there are some children who are going to have a strong, passionate math wizard connection to numbers. We don't, you know, that's not strange to us that there are some children who constitutionally are math geniuses. Nobody has a problem understanding that. Why do we have such a problem accepting the fact that there are also some children who constitutionally are going to be, in a way, you know, math deficient, are just not going to do it, no matter what we try to force out of them? Okay, let me unmute, and maybe some people have questions about this issue. This is the biggest issue for Waldorf parents nowadays, that children are not learning math, and that the teachers don't seem to know what to do, and that's, again, why we bring in specialists with all of their ditto sheets and all of their, you know, downloads from the Internet. And once again, the problem with the specialist is they know the subject, but they don't know the child. And somehow we have to bring what we know of the child to bear on teaching every subject. So, other questions or comments about this? If you have questions and you just think about them after the session ends, feel free to email me, because Friday will be our last chance to, you know, air all of our questions. Okay, well, if there's nothing else right now, email me, whatever you'd like to do. So I think I've said about as much as I can, and on Friday we'll look specifically at subjects, which means we'll go back to questions of learning disabilities and, you know, individual children who are really struggling with one or another of our many subjects and how to help them along. We'll do that on Friday. That will be our main theme, but I'll also take up any questions that you send me by email.